the CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, Adele, Cox Communications, Paul Weller and Dancing Jesus. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. And if you're listening to this the day that the podcast goes out, well, happy Black Friday to you, whatever that is.
It's Black Friday.
Does anyone know what that is?
Well, since Black Friday became a thing here in the UK, thanks to Amazon, let's not forget it was Amazon who thrusted this nonsense.
We should give thanks to Amazon for that.
This nonsense shopping day that is the day after Thanksgiving that makes no sense whatsoever in any country other than the one that has Thanksgiving on the last Thursday of November. But since Black Friday became a thing over here,
yep,
two things
occur.
Well,
it's now Black Friday week, because I've got some Black Friday deals on Wednesday.
Even though we also have Cyber Monday, the whole point of Black Friday is that Black Friday is High Street, and then you have Cyber Monday on Monday, which is the online stuff. But I say, because it came here via Amazon, it's a nonsense.
Nothing about it makes sense.
But there's two things have happened on Black Friday since it became a thing in the UK. One is that there will be the stories on the BBC site and some of the tabloids about the fist fights that have occurred in various shops this morning as people sort of fight.
Even though, do people not realise that you've been able to get things online all week?
for the big flat screen TV that's 90p, but there's only one of them, and so the big fist. So that's one thing. Mm. And then the other thing is the big debate about the origin of the term Black Friday, and is it offensive or is it not offensive, and what does it mean? And there'll be various theories as to where the term Black Friday came from. I think it began
as companies in the black.
I think it was a tribute to Cilla Black. I think that was where it originated
from. Is that what it
is? It was some Cilla Black fans used to go
out. Because there's a lot of bargains.
Exactly. Right, yeah. That's where it all came from.
And Cilla Black is very big in the US.
People have forgotten that now. But of course, it means this Black Friday is a little bit tinged with sadness, because this is the first Black Friday where the lady which it is named after no longer is of this earth. So I think it's a particularly sad Black Friday. But I don't want to bring this down at the start of the podcast.
No.
And anyway, you may not be listening to this on Black Friday. You may be listening to it on
Cyber Monday.
Or what could Tuesday be?
Tuesday.
So, that's a thing. But that's not what we're here to talk about today.
No, because this week on the CMU podcast, it's Adele week.
In fact, it's Adele day. Or was last Friday Adele day?
Last Friday was Adele day.
Because the album came
out.
This
is Adele week. Don't start questioning it. This is Adele week. I've just called it that.
But this is the day when Adele will top all the charts.
Yes.
Well, those countries that have a chart on a Friday, which is possibly only the UK.
Yes, because America's Tuesday still.
It is still later, isn't it? So, yeah.
That's it, the two charts.
Yes, yeah.
UK and America.
They're the only ones that matter. Who cares about the rest? So, yeah, Adele brought out a record last week. You may have noticed.
Yes.
Did you notice?
I did notice.
Have you listened to it yet, Andy Mole?
No.
And why not?
Because it's not on Spotify, and I don't like Adele enough to buy a record.
So, yes, the news... Well, actually, we got the news just as we finished recording the last podcast.
Yes, annoyingly, it was the first email I saw after we finished recording last week.
We got confirmation that the new Adele album, 25, is not available to stream on any on-demand streaming service. It ain't on Spotify, but crucially, it's not on Apple Music either. So this is not like Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift doesn't like her albums being available on freemium streaming platforms. She doesn't mind providing people are paying, but if there are some freemium people there, she doesn't want any part of it. So that's why Taylor Swift was on audio. Not that that's any use anymore. But she wasn't on Spotify and she wasn't on Deezer. But Adele is...
Well, no, audio's... at the moment, still exists.
There's still a few more days.
I think a month
of the most recent Taylor Swift album.
They've started shutting down. But that we're not talking about that this week.
Adele ain't on any streaming service. If you want Adele's new record, you have to do one of three things. One, go to a shop and buy it on CD.
Mm-hmm.
Two, go on iTunes and download it to a AAC player of your choosing. Or number three, pirate it. Because that's still an option. You can still go and pirate it if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. So she's not streaming. So basically she is windowing her release, as it is only slightly irritatingly called these days when artists decide that they're going to put it on this service first and then wait a few days, weeks, months, years, and then allow it to be streamed.
Yes. And it's a strategy that's clearly working for her. I'm going to say slightly contentiously and then... just knock it out the window in a couple of minutes.
And why do you say it's worked before you?
Because Adele has basically broken all of the chart records.
Yes, this record.
Well, all
is
of the
selling.
Chart records that relate to first week album sales.
This record is selling very well.
Yes,
I think is the point.
Which we were expecting. I mean, we knew that a lot of copies were being shipped in expectation of her breaking a lot of records.
Yes, so the physical orders, retailers, the reports we've been mainly getting in are UK and US, although we're hearing similar things from other countries too. So the physical retailers, whether that be Amazon or the High Street, have been ordering lots in, so lots of CDs have been pressed. We were expecting quite a high download count of this too. So none of that is a surprise, although we have had, as the week's been going on, the big two chart records that have had most chatter are the fastest selling first week most sales record, which is a snappy record to have. I'd like to see that on a plaque in both the UK and the US.
Yes.
So in the US, the record was held by
NSYNC
with their 2000 album, their
biggest selling album, which 2000 is called No Strings Attached.
Of course.
And that sold 2.4 million copies in its first week, which seems like a lot, but not in the world of Adele.
No, Adele.
Because she had beaten that record by Wednesday.
Yep, smashed that record and is getting close to 3 million. It might be just shy of 3 million, we reckon, by the end of the first
week.
Yes,
you might actually know already by the time you hear this podcast.
Indeed, because the first
week. Due to the annoying way they do the charts now.
The way time works.
Yes. God damn it, time.
And the UK chart record, the same record in the UK, was held by
Oasis.
With Be Here Now.
Since 1997.
It's that mad thing that their least good album is the one.
It's not their least good album.
No, they've done more rubbish albums than
Standing on the Shoulders of Giants.
Oh, that's true, of course.
Let's not forget that.
Yeah, I blocked that out of my memory. That's how bad that one was. As we were recording this podcast, it was announced a few hours ago that she'd smashed that record. Although the official charts company did sort of point out at the last minute, which I'd forgotten, Oasis with Be Here Now brought it out halfway through the release week for some silly marketing reason. So actually the figure that Oasis sold was not a full 7 days worth of sales.
So take that, Adele.
So Adele,
useless.
But nevertheless, Adele selling very well. And so to bring this back to where you started, your argument that you are positing for the purpose of then shouting down,
because some people would say this,
is by taking it off those evil streaming platforms, by stopping it being on Spotify and Apple Music. That is why Adele is selling so well, and that proves that records should not go straight onto the streaming platforms ever.
Yes, although let's debunk that immediately, because clearly Adele is awakening a lot of people who would not ever use a streaming service, probably haven't yet bought a download, very much are still in the buys 1 to 2 CDs a year demographic, which is a strong demographic. And that is why Adele is breaking records left, right and centre, because a lot more people like Adele than like any other artist at the moment.
Yes, and I think whenever you get big artists like this, so indeed with the Taylor Swift's albums or maybe a big Coldplay release, or when U2 did their silly thing with Apple, and of course Adele, who I think, you know, is certainly in terms of the Anglo-American repertoire, is the biggest artist of the moment, and we've known that even when we've been waiting for this album to come out. When big name artists do something, so they don't go on streaming, or they do go on streaming, or whatever, people will come out of the woodwork and say, well, what does this tell us about the music industry in 2015? And I think with big name artists, other than it is still possible to have big name artists who sell a lot of records, other than that, actually, it doesn't really tell us anything about the music industry in 2015. And the thing I always say is that most people are in the record industry. They're in the business of trying to sell records. Whereas Adele isn't in the record industry. She's in the Adele industry. Taylor Swift is in the Taylor Swift industry. And her management team, we're told Adele was involved in this decision, holding it back from the streaming services. But her management team and her label, they know the fan base. They know what's right for her fan base. And they're doing what they think is right for her fan base. It doesn't really tell us anything about what is happening
in
general.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm sure there will be probably a significant number of people who have gone and bought her album, even though they would normally only listen to stuff on streaming services. However, compared to the entire population of Adele buying consumers, the streamers are a small section, I would think.
The other thing to say is this probably was the right decision for Adele, and Adele should be allowed to decide where her music goes, and that's all great, blah, blah, blah. However, what I would say is, in terms of the wider music community, when Adele or Taylor Swift or whoever keeps their music off the streaming services, and certainly all the streaming services, in some ways, you could say they're not much of a team player, because actually the people who are paying, so not the freemium users, but the people who are paying for Spotify or Apple Music or Deezer or whatever, are the record industry's best customers. And in recent years, the record industry in terms of revenues has been more or less flat. Japan is a bit of a problem, but generally speaking, worldwide, the record industry in terms of revenue is flat and its profit margins are going up. And most of that achievement is down to the fact that this is ever-growing number of people who are paying £120 a year into the system through a Spotify or an Apple Music or whatever. And so they are the best customers of recorded music. They are the people who are helping the industry to sort of turn around its fortunes and to start to keep its revenues flat. And actually, in terms of profitability, the profits are going up.
And actually, probably for a large chunk of the people who are paying, they're probably not just paying £120 a year in. They probably are buying the odd download here and there, maybe a few bits of vinyl. They're the people who are spending way more than £120 a year for, maybe not the most part, but certainly a sizable chunk of people who are paying that out. People aren't just going, well, I don't want to buy anything other than my streaming subscription.
So basically, the record industry, and obviously, you know, the record industry is not Adele's problem. So, you know, she should do whatever she wants to do. But it is basically the record industry at large saying to its best customers, the people who are helping the record industry turn a corner, basically saying to them, you are our most important customers and you're not allowed our most important record. So I suppose the question now is, how long will she window it? Because Adele's catalogue is still on the streaming services. So how long will it be before they say, all right then, Spotify, Apple Music, etc. can have it? But as it currently stands, you can't stream it. If you are listening to this in the US, Pandora has it, as I assume just iHeartRadio and any of the personalised radio services, because of course they are licensed under a compulsory licence through the Sound Exchange system. So copyright law takes the power to keep your music away from those services, away from the artists and the labels. They have to make music available through Sound Exchange, so the album is there on Pandora, but of course because of the way Pandora works, tracks will be appearing in your feed if you're the sort of person who likes to tell music, but you can't go in and say play me the album in full, because that's not how those services work.
No. But that's not the only way that you can experience Adele, is it?
She's been doing the rounds, doing the promo cycle all week since that album came down. Actually, she seemed to be spending more time in the US than over here, although she did do that big BBC special. Did you watch the big BBC special?
I did not.
I didn't either. But there was one. I know that for certain.
And it was sold worldwide.
It
13
did.
Countries, I believe.
The BBC was pushing it out into other countries. There was some lookalike. She did a lookalike competition. That ruse. The artist famous people do sometimes. There was some comedic bit. Graham Norton hosted it. So there was a BBC thing.
Sounds hilarious.
But she also has a YouTube video of her doing, which of the late night talk show hosts is it, who redoes hit songs with the Roots?
Jimmy Kimmel?
One of the Jimmies. And they do it on sort of kids' instruments.
Yeah.
And there's that version doing the rounds. There's a Muppets version of the track, isn't there?
Of course.
So it has been a busy, buzzy week for Adele. Not only is the record out, not only is she doing the promo cycle, but actually, as we do the podcast, we've just heard that tour dates have been confirmed as well.
Yes, it's quite a long tour as well. I mean, as you'd expect, because it takes a long time to tour the world.
And also, she's been off the road and for a long time. She didn't even, of course, she didn't finish her last tour.
She broke her throat last time. She's definitely going to have a good go at it. She's starting in Belfast in February, end of February.
Well done, Belfast.
29th of February. Wouldn't normally be able to do that. And then she's going around, Ireland, playing four nights at the O2, up to Scotland, and then Glasgow, Birmingham, out to Europe, all around there. She has not yet announced US dates.
Oh.
However, the European dates run into the middle of June, which still leaves her free to headline Glastonbury.
Which is interesting, because you mentioned the four-night residency at the O2 Arena. That's not a surprise. Although you could say, why aren't she doing a bloody Wembley resident? You know, Ed Sheeran can sell out Wembley Stadium three nights. Surely Adele could do four nights at Wembley Stadium. But that sort of links into some of the things she has said about playing Glastonbury, which is she isn't that happy with the idea of playing to an absolute massive audience. I imagine, actually, her preference would be to be playing more sort of big theatre levels, or the Royal Albert Hall, for example. But commercially, she can sell arenas, so she's doing an arena tour, but she's holding off the stadiums. And there's been lots of speculation about, will she play Glastonbury, will she not? Partly because Martin Elbin, who is one of the bookers of Glastonbury and also founder The Great Escape, so we know him through The Great Escape, has spoken about Glastonbury's attempts to persuade Adele to play before. And at the M for Montreal conference earlier this month, he did say that conversations were ongoing. But Adele has talked about playing Glastonbury with media a few times. And I think there's definitely been some interviews where Adele has said she doesn't really want to play festivals, that's not her thing, although Glastonbury is the one that she might consider. But then there are other interviews where she's saying, oh, that's a really big crowd to play in the open air. I'm not sure that's my thing.
Yeah, she said, I mean, as recently as October, she said on the Capital FM, she couldn't see herself playing to a crowd of that size. But apparently they've spoken to her people, Glastonbury have, and she hasn't said no yet. But there's still time for her to say no. She probably will say no.
There is time for her to say yes as well. Perhaps she could do a little sneaky session in one of the tents or something. But anyway, it's been a very busy week for Adele. There are other records she's broken too. I won't bore you with what those are. There was the stat during the rounds that she was outselling the rest of the top 200 in the UK.
Well, I think apparently...
Someone was saying the top 1,000. Yeah. Never said that. Once you get below the top 200, most of those albums are only selling... Four copies.
It sort of becomes irrelevant.
So it sort of becomes relevant. And then there was something about she was X percent of the recorded music market in the world. 42% of the recorded music market in the world.
To be fair, not that many albums were released the same day as hers.
Understandably so.
Because you would be stupid to do so.
I mean, even One Direction and Bieber was the week before, wasn't it? Let them get out of the way, have their chart positions before the mighty Adele comes on the radar. But I think the biggest achievement, which we must mention, this is quite an achievement, and I'm sure this will... I suspect that the guys at XL will be amending her biog, is this is the first time we've done an artist-based story at the start of the CMU podcast.
Certainly since we returned.
That's how significant she is.
Another week when we've mentioned that there was an old podcast.
Well, you did it, not me.
I know.
Moaning at me last
week. This is the bloody Adele ruining my plans to cut free from that old podcast.
So if Adele is listening, when I finish this podcast, I'm going to go home. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually. I've got an event to go to, and then I've got an advert to design. But once I've been to the event, and I've designed the advert that has to be done because the thing it's going in is going to press tomorrow, then, oh no, I've got to send an email.
Would you stop?
There's a really important email that I've got to write.
You could have just said you were going home.
I'm going to design a little certificate. I'm going to crank up InDesign and design a little certificate. So Adele, the first artist to appear in the opening slot of the See Me podcast.
Bracket since we came back.
Bracket since we came back. Open brackets. Would you stop referring to the fact that there was an old version of the podcast?
Shut up, Adele.
Close brackets. And I'm going to send that off to her people. And I think in a week of achievements, I'm pretty sure that will be the one she remembers. So well done, Adele. Many congratulations.
Happy Adele week.
Yeah, happy Adele Day / week.
US ISP Cox Communications has been having a bad week, which shouldn't be the case because it's Adele week and nothing bad happens in Adele week. But in fact, two bad things have happened to Cox Communications this week.
It can't be a coincidence.
Do you want to do a recap? Not that we've ever talked about this before.
So here's a recap about a story we've never talked about on the CMU podcast. Not even on the old version of CMU podcast that we don't talk about on the podcast.
Yes.
Because this story is relatively new. So Cox Communications is a big internet service provider in the US. And about a year ago, just over, I think, it was sued by BMG and Roundhill Music. So two music rights companies. And they sued it, saying that it was not doing what it ought to do in order to help the music companies combat online piracy. So, in America, most of the big ISPs are part of a thing called the Copyright Alert System. And it's a voluntary program, but it's a little bit like what our Digital Economy Act, way back in 2010, was meant to set up but never did. Well, in America, they never got it through Congress, but they reached a voluntary agreement. So most of the big ISPs and cable companies in America under this copyright alert system have a process in place that if you're a record company or a music publisher and you suspect that one of their customers is file sharing or accessing content from unlicensed sources, then you send the ISP a letter and they then forward it on to the customer. And the letter says, "Oh, naughty, piracy, file sharing, stop," or words to that.
It's not a very clear letter, and so, if that's what it says.
That's how it works. So most of the big ISPs are part of this program, and I don't know whether it works, but generally the music companies, for the time being at least, are happy with that program. It was all renewed earlier in the year, etc., etc. However, Cox Communications is probably the one big internet company in the US who has never been part of that program, refused to be part of that program.
They've got their own thing.
Instead, they have their own thing. So they have their own system, and they say to music companies, OK, well, we're not part of the copyright alert system, but here's an email address. If you send us letters, we'll review them, and then we might forward them on to the customers. They stopped forwarding on the letters that BMG and Roundhill Music were presenting to them because they have a problem with this company called Rights Corps. So Rights Corps is an anti-piracy company who help rights owners from across the entertainment industry do the anti-piracy thing. And they're best known for managing this warning letter process. So they, on behalf of record companies and music publishers, identify people who are possibly accessing dodgy sources of content or file sharing. They then play the copyright alert system process or however they're getting the letters to these file sharers, and the letters go out. And it has to be said that other people have raised concerns about the content of letters that come from
yes.
Rights Corps. For two reasons. Often they will say, we know that you are, or we suspect. Even if they don't explicitly saying we know, they certainly imply that it's more than suspect. We know that you are infringing copyright. That's against the law. If this went to court, you could get stupidly large damages, because we know under American copyright law, you do sometimes get stupidly high damages. So you should send us $500 now to settle and then never file share ever again. And people have objections to those letters, A, because they sort of are encouraging people, rather than hiring a lawyer. Some people have alleged that they've picked a damages price that is just below what it would cost to hire a lawyer to give you legal advice.
Yeah.
So that one of the allegations is, oh, you're deliberately setting this up to encourage people not to consult a lawyer. The allegations you're making may or may not have substance, but you're pricing it in a way that people will not go and get legal advice. And that sort of goes against legal process. Also, it encourages people to write back to Rights Corps. And of course, Rights Corps don't know who these people are. All they know through their automatic monitoring of the internet is the IP address of the suspected pirate. But they don't actually know the name and address of the person using that IP address, which is why you have to involve the ISPs.
Yes.
That's why the copyright alert system exists. But by suggesting to people that they should write back to Rights Corps, they then provide their names and addresses to Rights Corps and therefore the music companies, which might then mean that they can be sued in a way that they couldn't be otherwise. So people have criticised these Rights Corps letters elsewhere.
Not least Cox.
And Cox Communications criticised them to the extent that they stopped forwarding them.
Yeah.
Rights Corps then said, but you are obliged to forward these letters under American copyright law. This is where we come back to safe harbours.
Mm.
Do you remember safe harbours?
I remember them, yes.
We talk about them quite a lot. So under American copyright law, if you're an ISP and your customers are infringing copyright, these safe harbours exist that say that rights owners can try and sue your customers because they're infringing, but they can't sue you, the ISP, even though it's your servers and it's your network that is being used for the infringement. So these safe harbours protect internet companies on one condition, which is that they have a system whereby if rights owners spot infringement, then action can be taken to stop the infringement. And that's where the warning letter system comes in. That is an obligation to ensure that ISPs get their safe harbours. And so the allegation of BMG and Roundhill was, by refusing to send on our letters, even though you may have problems with those letters, by refusing to send on those letters, you're not fulfilling your obligations under US law. Therefore, you no longer have the protection of the safe harbours. Therefore, we can sue you for copyright infringement because your customers are infringing.
Yes, but still, one of Cox's big defences would have been a safe harbour defence. However, this week, the judge overseeing the case made a pre-trial ruling and said, nah, you can't use that defence.
Yeah, so this case has been rumbling on for a year. It was due to go to court next month. In fact, I think it is still going to go to court
December,
next
yes.
month. And there were various documents being submitted in the run-up. We reported on those in the CMU Daily, some quite recently. One of the issues that Cox Communications had against BMG and Roundhill was that they were trying to present how much file sharing was going on Cox Communications network to show to the court it was a lot. But actually what they were showing was a lot of BitTorrent traffic on the Cox Communications network, and Cox Communications were saying, well, it's wrong to say that just because it's BitTorrent traffic, it is definitely piracy, because BitTorrent has plenty of legitimate uses too.
Yes.
So that was one of the complaints that Cox Communications made relatively recently. But yeah, sort of out of the blue, this pretrial ruling came from the judge. Various things in the pre-trial summary judgment, some of which went against BMG, and particularly Roundhill, mainly some of Roundhill's claims to even owning the copyright in the songs that are at dispute. But the crucial thing is that almost the biggest issue in the case, i.e. by not sending on these letters, does Cox lose the safe harbour defence, which was the main thing of debate, has already been decided. And the judge said, by not forwarding these letters, you are losing the safe harbour defence. So when it goes to court, I assume, I mean, it may well be that Cox try and backpedal on that summary judgment, I don't know. But in essence, It will be, well, was there infringement? And if so, what damages are due? The safe harbour conversation won't happen. And we expected this to be a court case with a lot of debate around safe harbours and obligations and whether or not there were certain standards of letters that the ISPs... We expect all of that to be debated in court and to provide more clarity on warning letter obligations, on the safe harbour rules, which, as we know, are controversial in music circles. But it looks like actually none of that will happen in court now, and it will be a much more straightforward case. So, an interesting summary judgment, not a good one for Cox Communications, and it sort of... I mean, who knows what will happen in court next month, but it does sort of seem like it is now swinging in BMG's favour, and Cox could end up paying damages to the music companies for the piracy conducted by their customers.
Yes, which leads us on to bad thing number two.
It does.
Because with its key defence refused, the company's insurer, Lloyd's of London underwriter Beazley, decided that it was going to refuse to cover the legal costs and potential liabilities of the case.
Yes, so a separate little bit of court action going on this week. Beazley have gone to court to try and get a judge to confirm that they are not obliged to pay either the legal costs, which rumour has it are already around about $1 million, such is the way with cases of this kind. Lawyers always win. And perhaps even more importantly, given that A, damages under copyright cases in the US can end up being stupid money. You know, you only need like 50 songs in the lawsuit and you can end up being millions and millions and millions. Plus, of course, there's potentially a precedent being set here that a whole load of other music rights owners, and particularly rights core customers, might then come along and say, well, hang on a second, in which case we should be able to sue under this precedent too. So there could be mega damages to pay.
Yeah.
And Beazley want a judge to say, no, it's not covered by the existing insurance policy, and therefore you don't have to pay the legal fees and you don't have to pay any damages on behalf of Cox if and when that occurs.
Yes, because Beazley is saying that by refusing to send out these letters, Cox was breaching its agreement for insurance and therefore has no coverage.
Yeah, what they say in their application is that, I can't remember the exact wording of the insurance policy, but it's basically liabilities and damages as a result of sort of the everyday running of an internet company, or words to that effect is what the insurance policy covers.
And Cox, it says, we're operating an intentional business policy of not forwarding Rights Corps letters.
So these liabilities are not just an everyday occurrence as a result of running an internet company. They are the result of a deliberate decision on the part of Cox Communications that Beazley were basically saying was a stupid decision.
A stupid decision that therefore removed their safe harbour defence and therefore opened them up to massive damages, and therefore Beazley wants no part of it.
So it'll be interesting to see what the judge overseeing that bit of legal squabbling, what conclusion they come to. And it will be interesting to see how this case runs as it goes to court. Will we get any more debate about the intricacies of safe harbours and takedowns and warning letters? Or will we go straight into BMG having to prove that infringement took place and then a damages conversation? So it may be that this case ends up going through the courts a lot faster. Or perhaps, having had a bad week in Adele week, what's coming out today that next week could be its week? Do we know? Coldplay have got an album coming out.
Actually, not this week.
No, but it might be the week of the court case.
It is.
It is. So in Coldplay week, perhaps things will sway in Cox Communications' favour. And perhaps at the last minute, it will all turn out that it's fine. And the fact that Beazley don't want to insure them won't be a problem. So who knows? We'll have to... Let's regroup during Coldplay week and see what happens in court. Time now for the CMU-approved part of the CMU podcast. Andy Malt, tell us about some music that you're approving and we should get excited about. What about Youth Lagoon?
Youth Lagoon recently released an album, his third album, called Savage Hills Ballroom. The song I wrote about, The Knower, was actually the subject of last week's Song Exploder podcast. So to find out more, you should just go and listen to that. One, because Song Exploder is an excellent podcast.
What happens on the Song Exploder podcast?
They explode a song.
Oh, they explode a song?
Basically...
Literally, they get it on vinyl and they blow it up.
They sit down with an artist and they take apart the recording of the song, so they kind of work out from the beginning how the song started.
So it's more of a dissection.
It's a dissection of a song, yes. A bit like, you know, do you remember the classic albums documentaries where they sat in the studio and they would like push faders up and down and go, here's some backing vocals. It's like that, but it takes 15 minutes.
Do they have a Westwood-style explosion at the start of the podcast?
No, but all podcasts could be improved by a Westwood-style explosion.
Well, perhaps Matt will provide one for this edition of the CMU podcast. given that it's Adele week and it's a special edition.
Yeah, yeah, so, special jingle of the week, so explosion. Who, and maybe get Tim Westwood in to just... get Tim Westwood in to re-record everything we've said. That's my plan.
Westwood could tell us why the Moton Media Songs of 2015 playlist was approved this week.
Well, because it just came out. It's the 20 best songs of the 1,500 songs-ish that Motown Media have released this year.
Do we need an explanation of what Motown Media is?
We probably do.
Obviously, regular readers of CMU, and certainly if you read any of the CMU Artists of the Year write-ups at the end of last year, will know all about this. But let's assume there may be a couple of people listening who have no idea what you're talking about.
Motown Media is one man, Matt Farley, a one-man songwriting machine who is on a mission to create a song for every possible search term. So if you search for something in Spotify or on iTunes, one of his songs will come up.
It began as an iTunes venture and then he shifted it on Spotify
as well. Yes, it's on Spotify as well. And he makes a certain amount of money from this and gets, people refer to him as a spammer quite often. However, those people that just haven't been listening carefully, because I think it is a very funny, and I am a big fan of any project that is just unnecessarily laborious for quite a small joke.
And so basically any words that you could put into Spotify, a song of his will come up. Yeah. So Christmas, Valentine's Day, shopping, love, children.
All kinds of things. School Psychologist, one of my favourite songs on the playlist.
Andy Malt would bring up a track.
Andy Malt would bring up a track. Although actually it doesn't come up very easily in the search.
Does it
I discovered
not?
This week.
What about Chris Cook? Have you tried Chris Cook?
I'd never listened to the Chris Cook song.
So 1,500 songs put out more or less this year,
which is down on last year because he released about 2,500-ish, bit less than 2,500. But he has also made a film this year.
So we'll let him off for doing slightly less songs this year. And of course, he did do the Chris Cook song this year, so that counts for at least 100, surely.
No, it's not as good as my song.
But this is the top 20. So he has picked his favourite 20 of the 1,500.
Yes, and they are good. So there's some songs from... As well as making a film, he also took a month off because he had World Motown Day for the first time this year, which was his attempt to make $1 million in a day from Spotify. That didn't work, and so as a punishment to
As a result of him not being Ed Sheeran, the only artist who could ever do that.
As a punishment to all of his fans who tried, he then took the next month off. He also recorded a solo album this year, which is more serious, and had, in fact, the first song, I think it's the first song on the playlist, is the classic, I now can't remember what it's called, but it's about someone driving a snowplough into his house. It's a very good song.
So go check out the whole playlist and listen to them back to back. Alas, neither the Chris Cook nor the Andy Malt song are in it. Is the Andy Malt song, was that this year or last year?
That was this year.
So both could have been in there.
Could have been in,
I
but
might
not.
Do my own top 20 of his tracks from this year. And it might just be my song.
It's in my playlist of the best songs of 2015. If you want to find me on Spotify and subscribe to that playlist.
So anyway, more approved. Deaths is next.
Deaths. I specifically put in a track called Mute Kids, but Deaths have a new EP out, their debut EP, called Under Old Sun. There sounds sort of there's a post-club is a term people use, which I didn't want to use, but I can't think of anything else to say. So it's sort of a late-nighty kind of sound, a bit downbeat electronic. But there are more interesting instrument choices than maybe a lot of artists working in that sort of field. There's sort of more of a mix of kind of some classical instruments coming in there, and it makes a more layered and intricate, interesting sound. I think, you know, it started as a solo project, this, and it sort of built up into a full band. So I think they're still very much developing. So definitely one to keep an eye on.
Or an ear on. Hey, if you were going to approve an up-and-coming Australian rapper, maybe one that's recently signed to Kitsune in Europe and Downtown in the US and toured with Mark Ronson years and years and Charlie XCX, who's very poppy but also has an edge.
Yeah.
If you were going to approve someone that would fulfil that description, who would you approve?
I don't know. Who do you think?
I can't think of anyone, so I'm relying on you to tell me who you're approving.
I think you should have a go at least pronouncing the name here.
Takei Meidzer.
Oh, he's so close. It's TK Meidzer.
Oh, I wasn't far off. I've already told you why that was approved.
Yeah, so go and listen to Ghost.
Go and listen online at completemusicupdate.com/approved.
Paul Weller. It's not Paul Weller week. It is Adele week. Let's remember that. However, Paul Weller might be having a little celebration of his own that makes it seem a bit like Paul Weller week in his house, because he has beaten the Daily Mail.
The big bad Daily Mail.
For the second time. So this story relates to some paparazzi photos of his children when they were out, well, him and his children, when they were out shopping in LA in 2012. He sued the Daily Mail publisher Associated Newspapers and won, which is fun.
He did.
But then Associated Newspapers appealed. And that went to the Court of Appeal last week.
He
won again.
Won for the second time. So this is an interesting case for various reasons. So as you say, Paul Weller was out with his children. So his teenage daughter, and then he has two very young children. And, yeah. and they were out shopping in LA. Paparazzo took the photo. It transpired, actually, that as more information of this story has emerged, that they did have a conversation with the paparazzo at the time, saying, we're not really happy with you taking our photos. And the paparazzo apparently said, oh, it's fine, because anyone who takes them, it'd only be your face, i.e. Paul Weller's face, because they pixel out the children's faces, because that's what they do when they run photos of people under the age of 18.
Not the Daily Mail.
Not the Daily Mail. And so then they sort of said, well, please stop taking photos. And the paparazzi went off with the photos he'd already taken, sold them probably via an agency to Mail Online, who then ran the photo with no pixelation and a big caption saying Paul Weller out shopping with his daughter and children and naming them, etc., etc. And as you say,
an important story.
yeah.
People go shopping.
For fans of singers shopping news, which I'm sure is a big part of what Mail Online offers its readership around the world. So, so Paul Weller sued on this. When was the original case? It was last year, wasn't it?
Yes.
And claimed that it was a breach of his privacy right and the privacy right of his children, which makes this an interesting case because this is all about privacy rights and privacy law. And privacy rights in this country stem from the Human Rights Act from the late 1990s, which basically comes from the European Convention of Human Rights. And so yes. In the European Convention of Human Rights, there's a line that says we as European citizens have a right to expect our private lives to remain private. So that sits in the convention and then was brought into English law through the Human Rights Act, whenever that was, late 90s. It was a Tony Blair piece of legislation. So that was what Weller was arguing, that this was a breach of his and his family's privacy rights under that bit of law. But these cases are always interesting because the same Convention of Human Rights, and therefore the same Human Rights Act, also provides a right to free speech. And that is where our free speech rights come from, as anybody who saw Chris Cook's free speech at the Edinburgh Fringe earlier this year would know, because I talked about that in great detail. I'm going to do that again in London in the spring. That's something to look
forward
to.
Stop plugging your stuff and talk about Paul Weller.
Well, it's all relevant to this. Perhaps I'll add Paul Weller to the show. So, free speech rights in the UK come also from the European Convention of Human Rights and therefore the Human Rights Act. So it's one of those interesting examples where we have two human rights that come from the same piece of legislation. Paul Weller and his family's privacy right, the Daily Mail and Associated Newspapers' free speech rights. The two collide. What do the judges do?
Now, the Daily Mail said that this would have serious consequences for all media who want to do important reporting on people going shopping.
And that was one of the reasons why they appealed the original ruling. And there was various arguments in the Daily Mail's case, both at first instance and also in the appeal. First of all, they tried to claim that the privacy rights of the Weller family had been lessened because of the activities of the family. Now, privacy law is very ambiguous in the UK. I say it comes from the Human Rights Act. It's a 15-year-old piece of legislation. And basically, the Act just says you have a right to expect your private right to remain private. And it's like, what does private life mean? What does that mean? How far should this right go? And so a couple of things that the Daily Mail said, first of all, was that Weller's teenage daughter had for about a year, when I think she was about 14 or 15, and she was, I think, 17 when these photos were taken, maybe 16, 17, but certainly under 18. For about a year, Dylan Weller had been registered with a modelling agency. And during that time, she had done a photo shoot for a magazine.
Teen Vogue.
Teen Vogue, of course. And so they said, so therefore, she's a model, so therefore her privacy right should be lessened. And the kids, the two very young children, well, their mother is constantly posting photos of them on Twitter. And I think there was a couple, they mentioned bare bottoms.
Their naked bottoms.
Yes.
Had been on Twitter.
So the argument being that, because what Paul Weller was basically saying is, OK, if I have to tolerate you taking photos of me while I'm shopping, because apparently that's news, well, I'm a singer, and even though I don't like it, I suppose I'm willing to tolerate it, but don't take photos of my kids. That's not on. And so the Daily Mail was trying to say, well, your kids are already in the spotlight. They're already out there. Therefore, that lessens the privacy rights of the family. And judges at both first instance and on appeal said that's irrelevant. Paul Weller said in the appeal submission, his daughter is not a model in any proper sense of that word. Okay, she dabbled, but she's not a working model. Yeah. So that's a nonsense expression. And you know, the fact that the mother has chosen to put some selected photos up on social media does not mean that it's now fair game for any paparazzo, any photographer to go out and take photos of the kids.
They also said he talked about the children in interviews. He said, well, I talked about when they were asked, but then tried to get off the subject.
Yeah, so both Weller and his personal manager in their statements to the appeal court did say, okay, yes, if family is brought up in an interview, then Paul Weller is not the sort of celebrity who will immediately say, no, not talking about that. But he won't voluntarily give lots of juicy details about what his family's up to. And they said he has turned down interviews with magazines where they think it's going to be more about his personal life than his music. So he's not somebody who is always in your face taking his family to red carpet events, trying to get his family in the spotlight. And so that shouldn't stand up. Another interesting defence by Associated Newspapers was that the photos were taken in LA.
Yeah.
And under LA law, so under Californian law, A, the photos are allowed to be taken, and B, if the Daily Mail or Mail Online was an American publication, then under American law, because free speech is much stronger in American law because of the First Amendment, and that therefore has a negative impact on privacy rights in the US, under American law, it's pretty certain that if TMZ had published these photos, then that would be fine. And so the Daily Mail was saying, we took them in LA, it happened in California, under the local jurisdiction there, we're allowed to take the photos, we're allowed to publish them. So therefore, we shouldn't be facing this. And the court on this was quite clear of saying, no, where you take them is not relevant. Where you publish them is relevant. And you are a UK-based publication. You're predominantly here in the UK. And therefore, you're under the jurisdiction of UK. Therefore, you're under the European Convention of Human Rights. That is not a defence. And so the original hearing, having pretty much completely sided with the Wellers and also awarded them damages for the breach of their privacy rights, the appeal court pretty much accepted everything that the lower court had said. And not only that, told the Daily Mail that they couldn't take this up to Supreme Court, so they couldn't pursue this case any further. So it's not that this is another stage of appeal and we still have more court hearing to go. That's it. The case is over. And as you said, the Daily Mail insisted that the original ruling would have serious consequences for celebrity journalism. And they were saying, we now are in a global market. We are competing with the big gossip sites in America. And we're now at a disadvantage because that we are constrained by this privacy right under the European Convention that doesn't exist in the US. But the judges were saying that's irrelevant. And as you say, why is celebrity shopping? If we have less celebrity shopping news as a result of this, then actually probably that is a good use of privacy legislation.
So yeah, although Godfather of Britpop goes shopping with his children is not my favourite crappy Daily Mail celebrity story. That is Woman Steps Over Puddle, which is a genuine thing they ran. I can't remember who, I think it was someone from a reality show, but it was basically, the story had like five or six pictures and it was basically just, this woman stepped over a puddle.
So is that a breach of privacy? Should you be allowed to step over puddles?
Is it a breach of the puddle's privacy?
Without it having intruded. Of course, as you may know, the current government are talking about abolishing the Human Rights Act, pulling out of the European Convention of Human Rights and writing their own nonsense. So it may well be that in a year's time, that all of this will become irrelevant and the Daily Mail will be allowed to publish as many photos of shopping strips or indeed puddles that they like. So another reason to stay in the European Convention of Human Rights, I think. But I thought it was an interesting case.
Yes.
Well done, Weller.
Before we get on to our last story of this week, just a few minutes spare to talk about some of the stories that didn't come up for full discussion this week. Once again, Paris. Not discussing that in detail, for partly for reasons that still feel like it's not quite appropriate for us to discuss it. Also, there have been a lot of stories related to that in the music business this week. I suppose the key thing is this week, the Eagles of Death Metal did their first big interview post-attack with Vice, which they talk about in some detail what happened, and also say they want to be the first band to play the Bataclan Theatre when it reopens.
So it's a 25-minute interview. It is quite harrowing, but it's interesting that they want to be so upfront about the experience and what impact it's going to have on the band. So, yeah, so various developments in that running story this week, but that was one of the key ones.
Benjamin Clementine won the Mercury Prize. He dedicated the prize to the victims of the attacks in Paris, because he has links to Paris. It's where he kind of started out his career. But, he won. He won and was not one of the people who we predicted as a winner. So,
but you think a justified winner?
I think a justified winner. It's an interesting album, interesting artist. It's his first album, and I don't think it's a perfect album. But I think he could go on to do some very good things.
So, interesting. Yeah. Obviously, Mercury Prize had a bit of a revamp this year, and it did feel a lot more low-key, despite them sort of really hyping up the shortlist on Six Music. It was on BBC Four. It wasn't quite the glitzy show. Not all the shortlisted acts performed this year.
No.
It was sort of on the same night as the Big Adele special, sort of completely gazumped it, I think, in terms of chatter. So a bit more of a low-key Mercury Prize. Whether that'll have any impact on the value of winning it, I don't know. But he gets, what is it, 20 grand or something? He gets a prize. Yeah. So well done, Ben.
Following on from our ticketing chat last week, the Society of Ticket Agents and Retailers put out a report this week saying that £1.3 million was lost to ticket fraud in the last 6 months alone.
Yeah, so
not just secondary ticketing, we should say, just like dodgy ticketing sites in general.
Yeah, so these are websites, and they did actually mention a couple in particular that sell tickets that don't exist. And this is based on stats from the police authority, where ultimately ticket fraud complaints go to. And it's part of a campaign. STAR, the Society of Ticket Agents and Retailers, have a kite mark. And basically they say members of that organisation sign up to a certain code of conduct to ensure that you can never be buying fraudulent tickets. These are primary ticket sellers, not secondary ticket sellers. And they're trying to raise awareness of the fact that when you're buying tickets online, you should be looking for the little STAR kite mark. Because if that is there, they're members of this organisation, which means you have certain protections and somewhere to go if something bad happens. So, interesting campaign.
The mega upload extradition hearing is done. Done and dusted. We're just waiting for a judgment now.
Yeah, so we won't say any more about that, because although there were various final arguments presented this week, they just went over the same ground. When the judge comes back with his decision, we probably will talk about that in more detail.
Wu-Tang Clan have finally sold their secret one copy album.
So although this is not a full story, so therefore we have to be quick. Also, I need to get somewhere. Quickly remind us what this is all about.
So Wu-Tang Clan last year announced that they'd finished a new album.
But they weren't going to release it.
But they were only going to press one copy of it, which they put in a box, and then auction to the highest bidder.
So there was a sort of a listening party, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, initially the plan was to tour it around the art galleries of the world.
In a sort of arty installation, you'd go in and you'd listen to it in the gallery.
But that didn't happen. Then they just played it once in LA, I think.
I think New York, but one or the other.
It was in America.
Yeah.
Anyway, they played it once. Whoever was in the room then heard it. Then it was put back in the box and put up for auction. That was in March this year. Apparently, the bidder put forward their bid in May, but it's taken till now to bash out the contracts. And that person, who was apparently an anonymous private collector in America, has paid millions of dollars for it.
So a Wu-Tang album that the only people who will ever hear... I mean, I suspect that he's not allowed to release it, and that will probably be part of the contract.
For a period of time.
So,
because there was a crowdfunding campaign for a load of fans who were trying to raise money.
And then they were going
to
share it.
And they were going to share it amongst themselves. But I think that might have ended up being in breach of their contract. Could have been difficult.
So the only people who will hear it for the foreseeable are the people who went to that event in LA, maybe New York, and whoever this... too rich for his own senses or her own senses person is, who has bought the album.
Yeah, so if you want to read about those stories in full, head to the show notes for this podcast, which you'll find at completemusicupdate.com, and you'll find links to all those stories in there. But now, let's get on to our final story, because I think you need to be somewhere in now 6 minutes.
I do. So let's get talking.
Let's get through this quickly. Dancing Jesus. What is that?
So Dancing Jesus was an online forum that was quite buzzy, particularly in sort of indie music circles. Oh, when were we talking about? 5-6 years ago, it first started to gain momentum, I think.
It launched in 2006.
So, more than that then. So it was a buzzy online forum for a time and became particularly known, I think. I mean, it did various things, but became particularly known for the tab, the bit where people shared links to unlicensed content. So like many of those forums, it would have lots of links to music that was stored on mainly the lockers, wasn't it? It was the period where file sharing stopped being sort of P2P and BitTorrent and became more people were putting up music to Mega Upload or to Rapid Share and those other locker services. And then there would be forums where people would go and say, oh, the new Block Party album, you can download it from this link, or the new whatever, you can download it from this link. And so it became known, certainly within the music industry, if not within the circle of people who use the site, as a hub for downloading unlicensed, dodgy, pirating, music industry-destroying content.
Yes. Now, it made headlines last year, although it was shut down in 2011, because the guy who set it up went to prison.
Indeed. So there was a police investigation into this site, which, as you say, led to it being shut down. It was actually stored on servers in the US. So it was a joint US-UK investigation that shut it down. The guy who set it up, and also one of the users who was particularly prolific at uploading links to unlicensed content. And I think it was the pre-release thing, isn't it? The record industry gets particularly tetchy where not only are you giving away links to music that people are downloading rather than buying, but it's the content that isn't actually officially out yet. And so there was a police investigation, and then it all went very quiet. So site shut down, we heard there was a police investigation, but then we didn't really hear anything else. And then we were told by the BPI, so the Record Industry Trade Body, by their anti-piracy unit, that a prosecution was being pursued. It was a private prosecution pursued by the BPI.
Yeah, because the police investigation had kind of fizzled out.
Yes, we don't really know what happened there, but anyway, we were told it's going to court. And actually, the guy that we're talking about, Kane Robinson, pleaded guilty pretty much straight away. The person who was prolifically sharing content initially pleaded not guilty, but by the time it came to court properly, this was all happening up north somewhere,
yes,
Newcastle way. One time it got to court, they both pleaded guilty and they went to prison. And that was A, why it became front page news, and B, why it was an important case for the BPI, and we started reporting about it in more detail at this point, because it was sort of the first time here in the UK that we'd had people running an online piracy site, a hub of file sharing and such like, that had actually gone to jail. Because in the early days of file sharing, most of the legal wrangling trying to stop file sharing online didn't happen in the UK. It was either in the US or in Australia or elsewhere in Europe. But crucially, most of the original attacks against file sharing, whether it was software or it was networks or it was search engines or it was online forums, were civil proceedings. So record companies usually, often through their trade bodies, would sue a technology company or a search engine or an online forum, ultimately suing them out of business. So sometimes they would win damages along the way. So obviously the LimeWire settlement in the US ended up being a megabuck settlement. But more often than not, it was less about making money and it was more about just putting enough pressure onto these sites, enough legal problems onto these sites, that eventually they'd just go offline. So most of the early file sharing cases were civil litigation, but in more recent years, we have started to see criminal actions against people running file sharing operations. Possibly because the feeling is the problem with civil litigation is, well, A, it takes forever to sue people off the internet. And B, if you're just a random person who hasn't got much money setting up a website in your bedroom, well, you don't sue poor people. You only sue rich people. And you don't need money to set up an online piracy setup. You need a bit of server space, but you don't need a lot of money. So there was a perception that civil litigation isn't working. It also didn't seem to be a deterrent. Every time you sued one service off the internet, another service immediately popped up, indeed had already popped up and gained momentum. So the consensus was in the music industry, we need to stop pursuing criminal action against these people because the thought of a jail sentence will be a bigger deterrent. And in the UK, this was the first case where we saw two people running an online piracy forum going to jail.
Yeah, and I think the music industry and the BPI are increasingly kind of pushing for harsher sentences for people running online piracy operations, because if you're running an offline piracy operation, which you're bootlegging lots of CDs, there are very strong punishments for that. That would include jail time. Whereas online, it's always been kind of a little bit of a fine here and there and slapped wrist and off you go.
And also, on when it comes to bootlegging CDs, I mean, there are cases go to court two or three times a year, every year, and they will always result in either a significant fine, and it is very common for these people to go to jail. So yes, the record industry has been pushing, of sort of saying, why are we treating online piracy differently to CD bootlegging. We should be pursuing criminal action. We should be pushing for harsh sentences. And this guy, Kane Robinson, got the maximum sentence that is currently allowed under law for online piracy, which was 3 years.
Yes, 32 months.
32 months. That's not quite 3 years. But nevertheless, not far off.
Yes, and this is something we're discussing now, partly because he was released slightly less than 12 months into his sentence earlier this month. And this week, Vice, Noisy, I think, has published an interview, quite a long interview, with Kane Robinson about how Dancing Jesus started up and how the case proceeded, telling his side of the story.
And it's interesting because, I mean, we were aware of the site, we were aware that it had been shut down, then it all went quiet, then suddenly we were being told, mainly by the BPI, that the criminal prosecution was now happening, and then it went to court, and then there was a prison sentence, and then it became suddenly front page news, and not only was it CMU covering this, now everybody was covering it. But I suppose what we never really heard was his side of it, and that's what is interesting. Do go, it's a long article.
So, yes.
But, you know, normally, I mean, Vice does have some longer articles, but even by, you know, Vice Noisy standards, it's a long article. But it's a very interesting read because it totally tells the story from his side. And as people who, well, obviously, we saw it very much from the industry's side, to then see it from his side is interesting. And the journalist who's written this for Noisy had been talking to Kane while he was in prison. However, he ended up that there were email conversations. Apparently, you can email prisoners. There's a website where you can email prisoners. But a lot of the questions got lost in the process. So in the end, they waited for him to get out of prison and they've sat down with him and told his story. And I suppose it is, I can't remember what our coverage was like, but certainly the tabloid coverage of this was sort of,
this is a criminal mastermind.
Yeah, criminal mastermind, online piracy, smashed, huge victory, to jail with you. Whereas, I mean, obviously, this story possibly has a little bit of bias as well. Although it is very much told as just some guy who started doing music websites, set up a forum, suddenly people were sharing files on it, never made any money out of it, never tried to make. Wasn't that it was a failed business venture. It was just a hobby. He paid for a bit of server space himself. And then suddenly the police arrived one morning, knocked on his door. And then a bizarre sequence of events happened up until his prison sentence, which it seems that he, not just through him being naive, because of what all the people around him were telling him, the prison sentence was a real shock when it came in court.
So, yeah, he'd kind of been told all the way down, like, from the police who initially arrested him, this will be fine, you just get a fine, doesn't matter. And then at the sentencing hearing, BPI suddenly said, yes, this guy cost the music industry £240 million, which is, that's quite a scary number. And it's still not entirely clear where that number came from. However, the sentencing then kind of balanced on this number, and it's, which is why he got such a strong sentence.
Yes, it went from fine to custodial sentence, and not only that, the maximum custodial sentence. And I suppose, to give a bit of the legal background here, the initial defence of Kane, and indeed anyone who runs these sorts of sites, is, well, I didn't host any of the content. All I did was provide a forum where there were links. These files were not on my server. We've had this conversation before. Under copyright law, we have this thing called authorising infringement in the UK. It's often called contributory infringement elsewhere. If you are enabling, equipping, helping other people to infringe, the fact that you're not infringing yourself is not in itself a defence. You can still be done for authorising infringement. So I think the case for infringement is quite straightforward. And although some people on the outside don't like that, the file-sharing community think that's wrong, legally speaking, that is quite straightforward. However, the interesting thing is, in most scenarios, copyright infringement is a civil matter. As I said, in the early days of file sharing, that was true. Generally, when copyright is infringed, the copyright owner sues. However, copyright can be a criminal matter, but generally, prosecutions only appear on the horizon when you have infringement, A, at an industrial scale, and B, for profit, which is why CD bootlegging factories are often done, because to set up a CD bootlegging factory, you've got to be quite serious about it. So you're doing it at an industrial
scale.
There's
some investment there.
And B, you're selling those CDs. There's money coming into your bank account. So you're profiting from it, and you're maybe profiting from it to quite a great extent. So that is normally when copyright becomes a criminal matter, which is why it's interesting that Kane Robinson insists that he never made a penny out of this operation.
So he never put any advertising on the site.
No subscriptions, no donations, no nothing. So this is not a case of he was making a lot of money out of it. So therefore, you're left with, well, one can only assume that it was deemed a criminal matter by the courts and a criminal matter that deserved a custodial sentence because of the scale of the operation, the fact that it was an industrial level piracy operation, which then comes to the point of the article, which is very sympathetic to Kane. And actually, I think if you read it, you will be very sympathetic towards this guy, is sort of saying that this 240 million, was it, figure, yeah. A, it was presented pretty much at the last minute. Now, nobody saw it coming. And B, and we've said this in our reporting over the years, I mean, not defending piracy at all, but the record industry is prone to wheel out these, oh, we lost £1 billion last month to piracy. And the figures are often, well, this many tracks were probably downloaded, and had we sold those tracks at 79p on iTunes, this is how much money we would have made. And it's always a sort of, well, that's not really what you've lost. Because people are getting that content for free via file sharing, they wouldn't have bought the content. They just would not have had the content. So those figures are always a little bit dubious. And I think one of the arguments here is that this guy only had legal aid solicitors, so didn't have specialist IP lawyers because he couldn't afford them. So there was nobody there in court on the day to say, hang on a second, what is this figure? Stop the proceedings. We need to investigate this figure. We're very dubious about this figure. Don't sentence until we go away and do a bit more research on this.
Yeah, so while he was in prison, his family and friends raised some money for him to hire a specialist lawyer, the guy who represented the founder of Oink,
which is another online forum, which was subject to criminal action.
Although he was tried under, what was he tried on?
Yeah,
fraud.
So Oink, with the Oink case, it was the first time the record industry tried one of these cases on a criminal basis. But because at that point they were still a little bit cagey as to whether or not the infringement charge would stand up in court, they went for conspiracy to defraud, which requires a much higher level of proof. And so they failed. They partly failed because they prosecuted him for the wrong thing, but the consensus was also that the guy who ran Oink got this specialist lawyer who did a really good defence, and if only Kane Robinson had had that lawyer, perhaps it would have turned out differently. And as you say, while he was in prison, his friends and family raised money to hire this guy, and this guy came up with a very different figure.
Yeah, £500,000, which is a lot less, although, again, it was sort of plucked out of thin air, really, to an extent. But now he's out of prison. He's on curfew at home, but he's out of prison, and I think as a result has decided not to pursue an appeal because, you know,
life's too short.
Let's
yeah, so there was...
He's only 23, the guy. He probably wants to just get on with doing other things.
So it's not looking likely this will go to appeal, even though this guy had been engaged and was sort of preparing a defence. And I suppose one of the points that the Noisy article makes, which to an extent is a fair point, is that the record industry wanted this case to set a precedent that, you know, if you run an online piracy operation, it could result in a criminal prosecution, which could result in jail time. So that was the precedent. But this matter was dealt with in a very low court, and it was a guy of limited means on legal aid representation. And perhaps if we're going to set precedents that apply to lots of people potentially operating websites, then we shouldn't be deciding these matters in low courts with non-specialist legal representation. Perhaps it would have been good if this had worked its way up the court system. Perhaps this should be heard High Court, Appeal Court, even Supreme Court, with some real specialist lawyers. Because, I mean, you know, I'm not defending the running of websites which encourage or enable or equip people to infringe copyright at all. And if you do run those websites, you are open to possible litigation and maybe criminal prosecution. That said, this is a very new area of the law. Things are constantly evolving, and it is probably true to say that it would have been better if these matters had been fought out in a higher court with better legal representation in the room, which is the ultimate conclusion of the article, that in essence, Kane Robinson was sort of used as a fall guy. He was an easy target that could set a precedent, and the music industry got what it needed, and he got a year in jail. Although he did say he learned more in his year in jail than he did in his 3 years at university.
So maybe we should all go to prison then.
So perhaps we should all go and spend a year in jail. So the one thing I did not know until I read this article is before Dancing Jesus took off, for a time he set up an Arctic Monkeys fan site, and the band liked it so much he did some web stuff for the Arctic Monkeys back in the days where they were very much an online buzz band. So perhaps...
And, yeah, the day before he was arrested, he'd been for a job interview at the NME.
So perhaps now, having done the record industry a favour of setting a precedent on piracy, someone in the record industry can do him a favour and give him a job designing their websites. Who knows? An interesting other side to a story that we covered earlier in the year. Go and check it out online.
Well, that's it for this week's podcast. Why don't you this week tell us, what would you teach yourself in prison? Tweet us at CMU. And don't forget to hit subscribe on the podcast so you can get it automatically next week, assuming you haven't already done that, which you probably have, because why would you not want this automatically every week? just remains to say that this podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU and from CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Online at completemusicupdate.com/approved.
Just a jingle of my keys there to finish that off.
completemusicupdate.com/approved.